This is a Round Table Podcast Showcase episode, 20 Minutes with Gail Carson Levine.
Hi everyone, I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast and this week's 20 Minutes with...
Yes, a special showcase episode where we sit down with the writers that have been so gracious in allowing us their time and insight and explore how that writer has gotten where they are, their process, their particular creative mojo. And with us today, we are deeply grateful to have Gail Carson Levine. Gail, thank you so much for taking time and joining us here on the Roundtable Podcast.
Well, it's great to be talking to you.
Gail, if you would let me, I just wanted to give a brief, very brief overview of some of the works and accomplishments that you've made since you made a commitment to your writing career for the benefit of our listeners that may not know the full extent of all that you've done. And if I overlook anything, please feel free to let me know, okay?
Sure.
Okay, so Gail she's probably best known for writing Ella Enchanted, which was adapted into a marvelous movie. But also, there are seven other novels in her work, Fairest, The Wish, Tale of Two Castles, several others, many of them adapting and riffing on beloved fairy tales. But also, there's a historical fantasy that takes place in a Mesopotamia-like environment, and also a historical fiction piece as well, Dave at Night. She has Princess Tales, a series of books that continue to explore the fairy tale theme with Princess and the Pea, Sleeping Beauty, Golden Goose, and others. She's also written three books in the Disney Fairies series. She has a book on writing geared towards, I believe, middle school age writers. Is that correct, Gail?
Upper elementary on.
Okay. Yeah. Called Writing Magic. She also actively makes herself available for school visits and conferences. She's enjoyed time on the New York Times bestseller list, LA Times, Publishers Weekly, School Library Journal, Amazon. Everyone has pretty much acknowledged that Gail's got some stuff going on. And I wanted to ask Gail, how your background is not necessarily the conventional author's background. And I wondered if you'd share with our listeners how it is that you came to be a writer.
Well, I was a very big reader, of course. I mean, not everybody who writes was a big reader as a child, but I was. I did write as a kid. I was the president of the Scribble Scrabble Club when I was a child. And I wrote into high school, and then I took creative writing from Mr. Pashkin. And he wrote on the top of one of my stories, "You know your problem, you're pedestrian."
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and I came across, I forgot about it, but I came across that folder of my of that year and saw it, and I remembered. And I remembered that I believed him. And I was very embarrassed. And I thought from then on that I couldn't write. And I was a philosophy major in college. And I did write a children's play that was performed in Brooklyn. But it was, in my mind, only a vehicle for my husband to write music, and he wrote the lyrics. And so I didn't think of myself as a writer at all. And I worked for New York State government for 27 years. And in the last 10, 11 of those years, I was writing. And it was because I worked for the New York State Commerce Department, and they had me writing their public service announcements.
Ah.
And it got me back into it. It got me interested in language. And because writing had been so important to me as a kid, and reading, it was writing for children that was always what I wanted to do. And so I started to take adult ed courses I was a philosophy major in college, which is not a good major.
Not for writers.
Writing, you know, anything but very dense prose. So I started taking adult ed courses. I took a marvelous course that's no longer given at the New School, but it was a workshop by a teacher named Margaret Gabel, who did it for 30 years and taught some very well-published kids book writers. And each week we'd give her our work from the week before, and we could give her as much as a chapter or even a whole manuscript. And she would get back to us with kind of an editorial letter and an edited version of what we'd given her. And each week she would read in class three selections from the work that she'd gotten the week before and turn the whole class loose on it. And because everybody, we all repeated the course, everybody was pretty advanced. The comments were invaluable. And Bunny's comments were invaluable. And I took the class, I think, for about 3 years. And I wrote Ella Enchanted while I was taking the class. So that was part of my education. I also started forming and joining critique groups as soon as I started writing. And also I started sending things out almost right away, even though I didn't know much about the field. I became educated as I went along.
As most of us do.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and it's very hard. It's even harder now, but took me 9 years to get published. I think that the thing that I did was the strangest was that I had myself taught self-hypnosis.
Really? And
my thinking was that maybe I could recover some memories. I do have quite a few memories of my childhood, but maybe I thought I might enrich it even more, and it didn't work, but but it was interesting, and it was, the degree to which I'd go to learn, and I read a lot of books about writing, and I went to conferences, and I joined Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which is a fabulous organization.
We'll include a link to them in the show notes on the website.
Oh, great, great. It is the largest organization of writers in the world, and it is most welcoming to beginners. So those were the things that got me, that helped. And while I was being rejected, I was having a great time because I was learning and I was meeting a lot of writers and I had a lot of support. So that's kind of it, I think.
That's an epic tale. I would imagine, as cruel as that teacher was to dash the creative spirit of a child in your youth, I can almost see that as kind of liberating in a way. A lot of writers, I think, wrap themselves up in the importance that they get published and that they be validated for their craft. And your approach was much more personal, much more intimate, and it was done for the love of the writing more so than the crafting of a career.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't anticipate a career.
Okay.
But I don't think that what Mr. Pashkin said was really positive. I don't think he was being thoughtful. I think that when I talk to kids about it, the message is that when people say something global about your writing, that's the time to not listen.
Sure. Mm. Sure. Yeah. Good or bad.
Yeah, that's true. And I do sometimes talk about the danger of overpraise, too. And when I teach, I think about that a lot. Because when one is overpraised, you start to worry about disappointing people the next time.
Yes,
and that can be almost as constricting as hurtful criticism.
Sure, sure. There was a recent article in Wired magazine talking about why some people learn from mistakes better than others. And in the study, they ran children through a series of tests, and they found, and then they had a second set lined up, and they could take an easy set or a hard set next. And when they praised the children for their intelligence, this sort of broad sweeping praise, the kids almost invariably went to the easier test as their second test. But when they praised the kids for the work that they did in the last test, very specifically, right, the kids, again, almost universally went for the harder test as their second test. And right, I think that's very telling, that if you want to praise somebody, be specific. Don't go for those global, overarching, oh, you're a wonderful writer.
That
doesn't help.
Yeah, and Gail, I am a high school teacher, and I've seen a lot of the damage that has been done from overpraise. And I think that's not just a matter of getting them to then feel like, oh, now I have to back off because if I don't succeed the next time, you know, that I'm not meeting that standard or that expectation that was set for me. But also what I see is when we overpraise or when, you know, students have been overpraised, they slip into almost a sense of apathy, that they know that they didn't achieve that level that they're being praised for. And they
don't
see
believe
the,
it.
Yeah, or don't believe it. And because it's kind of the, you know, oh, you didn't do an amazing job, but because you completed it, you know, I'm going to give you full credit. And that's really damaged, I think, a lot of our kids. And so they don't try as hard, and they don't think that they have to put in any effort because it's still very easy to get the praise. It's kind of like the baseball team that comes in last place and everybody gets a trophy. You know, there are some good things to that when the kids are very young, but there's also some damage that can be done there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Gail Carson-Levine after this brief promotional break.
Good things come in 52s. There are 52 cards in a deck, 52 weeks in a year. The B-52s? There's this comic book reboot thing DC is doing. Okay, so there really aren't that many. But one thing that does come in a bundle of 52 is my ebook giveaway. This is the year of 52 weeks of indie. If you go to 52.scottroche.com, you'll see all the books I've given away, an excellent way to learn about new authors, and you can enter to win the ebook for the current week. It's usually as simple as dropping a comment on the blog. So if you'd like to win an ebook or just find out about some awesome independent authors, stop on by.
Now let's get back to our showcase episode with Gail Carson-Levine. Gail, I wanted to ask, you know, you are an accomplished, and here I go giving sweeping praise, you are an accomplished writer. Your works are marvelous. I was curious, as you know, with the talent and the background and the workshops and study that you did, why you chose to pursue YA and children's literature for your initial forays into writing.
Well, it's because reading as a kid was so important to me, and I'm not nearly as much of a reader now as I used to be. I have gotten very interested in poetry, and I am writing poetry for adults, but not fiction.
Yeah. In terms of your process, my creative writing kids right now, this is actually fairly timely, because what we've done is I'm wanting them to see the difference between some plot-driven fiction versus character-driven fiction. And so I'm introducing them to fairy tales as almost plot summaries, and then asking them to delve into the main character and really find what the thread of that character is and who they are as a person, as opposed to just this caricature that was created for the purpose of putting forth the plot or the events that then take place. And so when you treat, or when you work with your in fairy tales specifically, but just in terms of your overall process, what is your approach to to a fairy tale. How do you get into your process of taking it apart and what things are important to you that you then want to work with?
Well, I think that I am a plot-driven writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I was thinking about saying that, I was thinking that maybe, you know, I don't really know. Maybe I am. But it seems to me that I am. Right. And when I look at a fairy tale, for example, often I'm looking for the gaps in logic. And so, for example, The Princess and the Pea. There are a few gaps in logic, like why is that a test of a true princess?
Right.
Is pretty obvious one. So I had to think about who she might be. And that's one of my princess tales. And I just went with the humor of it. So it's not only feeling a pea under all his mattresses, it's finding a little bit of macaroni in a salad, it's finding hey, it's, you know, one right. cockamamie test after another. In Ella Enchanted, it was the kind of mystery that the whole book turns on is why is Cinderella so obedient to that step family? And everything comes from that.
Right.
In my most recent novel, which is A Tale of Two Castles, it's the first mystery I ever wrote. I thought I would try my hand at a mystery. And I went to fairy tales and I looked at the one that I found a mystery in was Puss in Boots. And in there, if you remember the fairy tale, Puss goes into a castle and vanquishes the ogre, convinces this dumb ogre to turn into a mouse and then eats the mouse. But if you think about it, there are no witnesses. So my taking off point was what might really have happened in that castle.
Okay.
So yeah. That's how I approach it.
Right.
So you pick your topic, pick in this case a fairy tale. You find those inconsistencies and or those questions, those sticking points that glare out at you. Identify a possible alternative in the case of Ella, the curse of obedience. What's your next step? What happens after you've pondered this, you've thought about it, you've found your hook and the foundation that you want to build on? What's the next step for you?
I write a lot of notes.
Okay.
I don't outline. I write a bunch of notes and then a beginning kind of swims out to me and I start writing. And in the case of Ella and quite a few of my books, I wander around, then I get lost. And I get stupid. And I write hundreds of pages that I don't need. And then I very slowly find my way. So I'm thinking that I wish I knew how to outline.
Well,
Jackie may feel after hearing this, listen to me.
Well, and you know, we speak with many authors during the course of the show, and there are broad categories that are called outliners and pantsers.
Absolutely.
The pantsers writing by the seat of their pants. And it sounds like you're kind of a synthesis. I mean, you take copious notes, and I wanted to ask: those notes are those character notes? Are those plot notes? What is it that you're exploring during that phase that leads you then to say, okay, now I'm ready to start writing?
More often, I guess they're both plot and character.
Okay, one of the things that I think many writers deal with is crafting authentic characters, making characters that resonate, that speak and are engaging and believable, connectable, lovable. Is there a way that you approach character development that works for you to find if a character is proceeding correctly or if perhaps it needs some tweaks?
Well, I'm most often thinking about the role of the character in the story.
Okay.
But also, I've had some trouble with likable main characters, and I've had to depend on my editor sometimes to tell me where my main character isn't so likable. Hmm. So that's been a problem in a few books.
Okay.
Do you let me reframe what I'm about to ask in my brain for a second. I'm going to throw out an assumption, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because this is coming purely from observation. But it seems to me that especially with my students, they have a hard time following along with something that doesn't move fairly quickly. And so I've been starting to think that maybe presenting them with a lot of short stories could be a lot more valuable than some longer pieces, especially if the longer pieces tend to go into a lot of character background and a lot of description and those kinds of things, because they just kind of, it loses them. So how important is the pacing of your books? Because you say that you are more plot-driven, and I think that's fabulous because I'm kind of more into genre fiction anyway, which tends to be more plot-driven. So do you find that it works well for you to pace it up and to keep those plot events coming fairly quickly, or how do you pace out your novels?
Well, I don't pace them out, but I do have kind of an alarm bell. It starts going off in my head that starts chiming in boring, you know, so then right. I know. And yeah. I do a lot of cutting.
Okay.
When I'm revising, I'm cutting. And when my editor sends me back the manuscript, she generally wants me to cut more. So there's that. In the book that I'm writing right now, and a lot of it takes place inside a mountain, and I felt that people are going to get very claustrophobic, if not bored, with that as the constant setting. And what I did was I switched point of view so that there are characters who are not inside the mountain, and I give them chapters. And I feel that breaks it up and wakes things up.
Okay.
So I am very aware of that.
Yeah.
Well, and that raises a point. You have the alarm bell that goes off when you've hit the boring mark. And that's really an instinct. I'm fairly certain that's not something you particularly studied for. And I know that a lot of writers, myself included, are constantly working to hone those instincts so that as you're writing, you have a guide, you have something that you can rely upon to know when you've deviated off course. And this is pure conjecture and opinion, how do you think that instinct evolved in you?
Well, it's still evolving.
Sure.
And a lot of the time, and this is a reason why not to be too hard on oneself while writing. A lot of the time I write too much because I'm figuring it out.
Okay.
So I'm putting down in the story stuff that I need to know but that the reader doesn't need to know. Mm-hmm. And then I wind up taking out. So a lot happens in revision.
Okay.
I also do want to mention that I don't stop taking notes once I start writing.
Really?
So I'm toggling back and forth between my manuscript and my notes all the time.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, do you use, what software do you use, or do you use software when you're writing?
I use WordPerfect.
WordPerfect. Oh my goodness.
Excellent.
That's old school. That's awesome.
Yes, very old.
That's outstanding. Well, I can see by the ticking clock that our 20 minutes with Gail Carson Levine has drawn to a close, and I'm, as always, Brannon, I know you share this feeling. It's always too soon. There's so much more to explore. Gail, thank you so much for taking the time, for sharing your thoughts. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
Excellent. All right, friends, that wraps up this episode of 20 Minutes With. We've been speaking with Gail Carson Levine, author of children and young adult novels. We'll be including links to her various websites and books in the show notes. Please do check that out. Brian, anything else before we wrap up?
No, I think you've said it all. I think we're good to go.
Excellent. Excellent. Great. Well, as always, thank you all for joining us. Tune in next time. Until then, keep writing, take care, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.